There is a Greek myth about a man named Sisyphus who was punished by Zeus and was ordered to push a boulder up a hill over and over for eternity. In today's story, our hero is punished in every way possible, but still, for 61 years, he picks up that boulder and keeps rolling it up the hill with the hope that one day things would change. The story you are about to hear has never been told before. Welcome to the 45th episode of Tracing the Path with Dan R. Morris. Our story begins in 1850 with China on the brink of a civil war. But this would not be like any other civil war, even though it happened a few years before the American Civil War. It is sometimes referred to as the Taiping Revolution, but it was more of a civil war than a rebellion, matching the Manchu-led Qing Dynasty against the Hakka, a group that descended from the Hans. And unlike most civil wars where one intends to overthrow the other, the Taiping merely wanted to radically reform it. Life in China under the Qing Dynasty had experienced a series of famines, natural disasters, and economic problems. Farmers were overtaxed, and the opium trade had affected the trade balance. The Taiping were a faith-based group interested in Christianity, their leader being a self-described brother of Jesus Christ. In 1953, the Taiping had their first major victory, overtaking the city of Nanjing, forcing the Qing to redouble their efforts. The battle was largely fought in South and Central China, largely affecting the province of Hunan. There, a self-taught political scientist named Zhou Suotsung-tang would rise to fame. He was initially hired to be the advisor to the governor, but his true skills shone through. With his understanding of the political environment, the needs of the Chinese people, and the needs of the overall economy, he rose to power. His innovative ideas landing him as the commander of a 5,000-soldier volunteer army, to which he drove the Taiping out of Hunan, all the way back to Guangdong by the coast. And then in 1863, he was made Undersecretary of War, and in 18 months completely dethroned the Taiping, ending the war. In 1865, he saw China in a weakened state and created the first modern shipyard and naval academy. A great deal of damage had been done to the country. He believed the only way to prosperity was through an educated citizenry. He advocated agricultural reform, removed the poppy and opium farms, and replaced them with cotton. This spurned a new textile industry, which created thousands of socially acceptable jobs for women. And he opened a printing press to print pamphlets of Chinese philosophy for the people. Zhou Suotsung-tang has since become a national hero, and always a hero of Hunan. But the war he helped finish was devastating. It is still considered the bloodiest civil war ever, the bloodiest battle of the 19th century, and some put it on the list of the worst battles of all time. It affected 30 million people in China, forcing them all to relocate or leave China altogether. The mass exodus of Chinese laborers created a new industry almost overnight. As the world was battling its position on slavery, a Chinese population willing to work for very low pay was seen as the answer for many. Chinese laborers were brought into South Asia and Caribbean markets to work on sugar plantations. The British brought labor to its colonies everywhere. But the unscrupulous treated the Chinese as slaves, and word soon went out that Chinese laborer slaves were available for trade. When Britain got word of the mistreatment and slavery in Peru and Cuba, they closed the ports immediately. Many of the Chinese laborers were poor. They didn't have money for this kind of a trip. so they were forced to offer their houses as collateral. Others agreed to become indentured servants, and many signed contract labor agreements. It was 1847 when the first ship carrying laborers arrived in the United States, but rumors of a gold rush in 1848 accelerated that immigration a thousandfold. By 1849, 20,000 Chinese had arrived in California looking for gold. In 1848, San Francisco had been a town of 800 people, but only 2 years later, it was a city of 25,000. 80% of the gold rush miners were Americans from out east, all having had made great sacrifices to be there. At the time, there were no highways or railroads, and leaving for California meant no connection to family or loved ones either. And the gold was there, but much harder to get than rumors led on. Most only found gold dust and smaller pieces, part of which they owed to the landowner of the mine. The presence of the Chinese made finding gold even harder, as fewer places were available for any particular miner. And since the Chinese had to send payments back to China, or fear losing their homes, for instance, they were willing to work for much less money. For Central Pacific Railroad, lower-wage laborers was an answer to prayer. With a growing population out west, the U.S. government had already extended money for homesteading, money for roads, and gave money to railroad companies to build a transcontinental railway. Central Pacific went to San Francisco to hire the low-wage Chinese workers to help build the railroad. And in most cases, they were eager, because California was quickly becoming a hostile place to live. Since the Chinese helped lower the wages and took all the railroad jobs, an anti-Chinese sentiment was starting to build. California politicians responded to the situation first by levying a $20 a month miner's tax on any foreigners who came to mine gold. With gold already hard to find, the Central Pacific Railway offer was a good one. Over 10,000 Chinese laborers helped build that railway. Because they needed money, and culturally were very hardworking, they exceeded every expectation the railroad put on them. Desert heat, freezing winter, mountains, tunnels, bridges, all got built with efficiency. In fact, Central Pacific Railroad finished 7 years before the government deadline. Life in California for the Chinese, however, did not improve. In fact, it got worse. In 1854, in an expansion of America's racist past, the California Supreme Court ruled that, like the black man, a person of Chinese descent was inferior to whites and therefore couldn't be used as a witness in court. That ruling made it virtually impossible to be persecuted for crimes against the Chinese. And then, in 1863, President Abraham Lincoln got involved. Deep into his campaign to free the slaves in the U.S. South, he signed a law banning the importation of Chinese citizen slaves and banned Americans from doing business with Chinese laborers, all in the name of ending the brutal Chinese slave trade. Nevertheless, its implications to the Chinese already in America was severe. Many found it even harder to find work, and were forced to leave California in search of the few jobs available. Some realized that opening their own business was the employment answer, so they began opening restaurants and laundries and shoe repair shops. Urban areas and Chinatowns began to grow, where the Chinese people could live and work near other Chinese people. They even formed their own associations and clubs to help one another. Laborers who didn't have the wherewithal to start their own business could find labor jobs, but often far away. A rumor of gold in Deadwood, South Dakota, moved a large population there. Others sought jobs in nearby states like Washington and Oregon. Ah Bing, a Chinese immigrant from the Manchurian part of Canada, moved to Oregon, where he found work as a foreman of a large farm owned by Seth Llewellyn. He brought gardening knowledge from China, but also learned quickly about grafting and cross-pollination. In 1875, Seth and Ah crossed the Black Republican cherry plant with the Royal Anne to create a new line of cherry. It was much better suited for the dry summers of Oregon and had a deeper, tartar taste. They named the cherry after Ah. You would know it as the Bing cherry. Back in San Francisco in 1880, the city enacted another law designed to discriminate against Chinese immigrants. They passed an ordinance that required all laundries to hold a permit issued by the Board of Supervisors. And although people of Chinese descent owned 90% of the laundries, none of them were issued a permit. For laundry owner Yik Wo, this was his livelihood, so he kept operating without a permit, but was soon imprisoned by the sheriff. Yik sued the city, claiming his rights were violated under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, and the case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court ruled in favor of Yik Wo, enforcing the 14th Amendment that laws could not be applied unequally. The Yik Wo case became the basis for the 1960 Brown versus Board of Education case during the Civil Rights Movement. On the other side of the world, Edward de La Boulaye had been watching the anti-slavery movement in the U.S. He ran the Anti-Slavery Society in France and needed Abraham Lincoln to come through as a shining example for the world. In 1863, just after Lincoln passed the law banning the Chinese slave trade, he signed into law the Emancipation Proclamation, freeing the slaves, on paper, in the United States. La Boulaye felt France should send a gift to the United States to commemorate this accomplishment, and suggested a giant statue honoring liberty would be perfect. And he suggested it be received and unveiled in 1876 for the 100-year anniversary of the United States. Unfortunately, the Franco-Prussian War would hinder that timeline significantly. The French team, working on the gift, came to the conclusion that a woman holding a torch could be the monument. The U.S. already featured the likeness of Columbia, a woman holding a torch on its money as a symbol of freedom. To meet this centennial deadline, however, it was going to involve a lot of work very quickly. They would only be able to produce a small piece of the monument. And so the artist Bartholdi crafted the head and the torch arm and sent them to America for the centennial celebration. They arrived in 1876 and were on display in Philadelphia and New York for 6 years, until 1882. Prior to that, Bartholdi had visited the United States and fell in love with Bedloe Island as the place for the monument, as it would be seen by all the immigrants coming into New York Harbor. So in 1882, the head and the arm were sent back to France for final construction of the monument. Meanwhile, the United States was responsible for raising the money and building the pedestal that it would stand on. That effort was led by a group in New York City calling themselves the America Committee. They didn't have a lot of luck raising money until they asked Joseph Pulitzer if he would help. Shortly thereafter, they had raised all the money they needed. Incidentally, on the America Committee was a 19-year-old named Teddy Roosevelt. Finally, in 1886, President Grover Cleveland would preside on a yacht for the unveiling and dedication ceremony of the new Statue of Liberty on Bedloe Island. But not without controversy, and rightly so. Back in 1882, when the head and arm were sent back to France for final construction, President Chester A. Arthur had something else on his mind besides the Statue of Liberty. He would sign into law the Chinese Exclusion Act, banning all Chinese immigrants, with a few exceptions, from coming to America. Imagine this, the President of the United States, with the right hand building a monument to honor immigrants, and the left hand signing a law to ban one. In 1884, the New York Sun had featured a letter from a New York attorney, New York resident, and Chinese immigrant, Sam Song Bo. He had just received the letter from the America Committee asking for donations to build the Statue of Liberty pedestal. His letter to the Sun reads, "A paper was presented to me yesterday for inspection, and I found it to be specially drawn up for subscription among my countrymen toward the pedestal fund of the Bartholdi Statue of Liberty. Seeing that the heading is an appeal to American citizens to their love of country and liberty, I feel that my countrymen and myself are honored in being thus appealed to as citizens in the cause of liberty. But the word liberty makes me think of the fact that this country is the land of liberty for men of all nations, except the Chinese. I consider it an insult to us Chinese to call on us to contribute toward building this land a pedestal for a Statue of Liberty. Liberty, we Chinese do love and adore thee, but let not those who deny thee to us make of thee a graven image and invite us to bow down to it." Sam Song Bo. Despite all that was put in front of the Chinese immigrants, they were still determined to prosper and would continue pushing that boulder up the hill, making changes along the way. Since immigration was now limited for the Chinese, being that only merchants and family of merchants could enter, a new industry popped up: paper families. Chinese immigrants could buy paperwork that said they were sons or daughters of merchants, and if they could successfully answer all the questions at the border, they might be able to make it through to America. One of those who had to use the paper system was Liu Gemgong. Liu was only 15 years old when the Chinese Exclusion Act was put in place. He'd come to America with his uncle in search of gold, but found himself working in a shoe factory in San Francisco instead. In 1874, he was approached by a shoe factory owner in Boston, 3,000 miles away. The owner's employees had gone on strike, and he needed experienced shoe workers to come to Boston to work on the factory and break the strike. He was one of 75 Chinese workers to say yes. And it was in Boston where he started attending church and learning English. He also met Fanny Burlingame, who he became fast friends with, and went to live with her as the gardener of her estate. Fanny, coincidentally, was the cousin of Anton Burlingame, who had been the first U.S. ambassador to China. It was Anton who first opened the door to trade and immigration with China. In the 1880s, Liu got sick and went back home to China. But life was too difficult there, so he boarded the boat and returned back to the United States. However, since he left, the Chinese Exclusion Act had taken place, which meant Fanny Burlingame had to forge papers herself, insisting that he was a merchant opening a store in Massachusetts. The Burlingames also owned land in DeLand, Florida, which is where Liu eventually moved and lived. During his first year there, the winter had been so harsh it had killed their orange trees. With the training he'd gotten from his family in China, Liu set out to make a sweet orange that that was also frost-resistant. He began to graft oranges until he developed the perfect fruit. The orange was quickly named after him, the Lu Gim Gong orange. But because it sounded a little bit more exciting for marketing companies, today you know that orange as the Valencia orange. In a similar story, in 1898, it was a Chinese immigrant who put citizenship and the U.S. Constitution on trial. Wong Kim Ark was the son of Chinese immigrants and had been born in the United States. Upon returning back to the U.S. after a short trip home to China, Wong Kim Ark was faced with the Chinese Exclusion Act. He was denied entry and sent to Angel Island to await his paperwork. In the meantime, he filed suit against the government, and the case went to District Court in Northern California and to the California Supreme Court before landing in the hands of the United States Supreme Court. This time, the case was about the citizenship clause of that same 14th Amendment. The question asked was whether you were truly a U.S. citizen if you were born on U.S. soil to non-citizen parents. The case had never been tested. And in a 6-2 decision, the court found for Wong Kim Ark and every future baby born on American soil. The Wong Kim Ark case is still being battled today as politicians are faced with an anchor baby pandemic in the United States South. Since the Exclusion Act barred the Chinese from working, many were forced to open their own restaurants. To make the food more inviting to the Western palate, they largely modified their recipes. One of those became a runaway hit that every Chinese restaurant would advertise. It was a simple mixture of noodles, meat, and vegetables called chop suey. Two small changes assisted immigration after that. The first was the 1906 San Francisco earthquake, which destroyed a great many buildings and birth records. It actually gave immigrants a chance to claim citizenship, knowing that there were no birth records to find. And then, in 1915, a federal law was clarified in court. From an immigration standpoint, merchants were allowed to come to the United States. But the new case indicated that restaurant owners were technically merchants and were entitled to bring employees into America as well. That created a Chinese restaurant boom in the United States. The different Chinese cultural associations would help find small towns where a competing restaurant didn't exist until, basically, all of America was replete with Chinese restaurants. In fact, today, Chinese restaurants outnumber McDonald's, Wendy's, and Burger King combined. The Chinese Exclusion Act would not be repealed for 61 years, not until World War II in 1943. The U.S. needed better relations with China and a bigger labor force, so it was repealed. But it wouldn't be until 1972 that an American president would visit China. Richard Nixon made the trip. President Nixon's trip would change the perception of the Chinese and Chinese food forever. During his trip, Nixon was invited to a state dinner in the Hunan province, and the media took pictures of that night's menu. Chinese restaurants everywhere jumped at the chance to introduce Hunan food and to offer President Nixon's meal options. People flocked to Chinese restaurants to try it. Michael Tong of Shunli Palace in New York City decided to offer a new dish. He'd experienced the dish at Chef Peng's Hunanese restaurant in Taiwan years prior, but he had his own take on it. It was a sweet and spicy, deep fried chicken dish that he decided should be named after the famous Hunanese statesman who'd helped quell the Taiping Revolution and stop the war. That man was Zhou Tsoetsung Tong. But since his victory with the 5,000-strong army, he had always been known as General Zhou. Thus, Michael Tong named it General Zhou's chicken. As part of a news segment, Eyewitness Gourmet came to Michael Tong's restaurant and talked to him about this new Chinese dish. And afterwards, over 1,000 requests came in for the General Tso recipe. That was 1973. That brings us to our final tale. After the assassination of Tsar Alexander II in 1881, Russian Jews fled the country, many emigrating to New York, just in time to see the head and torch of the Statue of Liberty before it was returned to France. The poet and humanitarian Emmett Lazarus stepped up to help these new immigrants by establishing the Hebrew Technical Institute, which would provide vocational training. She also wrote a poem as a way to show empathy for the refugees, and she offered the poem to the Statue of Liberty Pedestal Fund to be put into a silent auction. Its most famous line reads, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless tempest-tossed, to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door." Despite the statue and poem, for 61 years, the golden door was closed to our Chinese friends and neighbors. It was only because of World War II that Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Magnuson Act, rescinding the Chinese Exclusion Act, giving the Chinese a chance to come to America again. He signed this Magnuson Act exactly 666 days after he signed Executive Order 9066, which put all people of Japanese descent, including U.S. citizens, into isolated incarceration camps until 1943, as a response to Pearl Harbor. Welcome to the land of the sometimes free and home of the incredibly brave. But before we end our story, let's look at some of the tales that hit the cutting room floor. Samsung Bo published his essay in the New York Sun, which was the same newspaper that printed, "Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus." In 1922, Kin Chu Cafe in L.A. was the first restaurant to offer permanent home delivery. Just before the Exclusion Act was abolished, Lee Hoi Chun and his wife Grace Ho were allowed to come to the United States to perform. He was a famous Cantonese opera singer, and they were performing in San Francisco's Chinatown. While on tour, they gave birth to a son, who claimed citizenship based on the Wong Kim Ark citizenship law. That boy, who would eventually grow up and live above a Chinese restaurant just outside of Seattle, was Bruce Lee. Incidentally, Wong Kim Ark's son joined the U.S. Merchant Marines. Yik Wo, the laundry store owner who proved the Chinese laundry tax to be unconstitutional, went home to visit China before the Chinese Exclusion Act and wasn't heard from again. Ransom E. Olds, the automobile millionaire who'd started Oldsmobile, purchased 37,500 acres of land in Oldsmar, Florida. He hired Liu Gingong, the creator of the Valencia Orange, when he was 60 years old, to come manage his garden. Today, one of the roads in Oldsmar is named Gingong Road. Emma Lazarus's poem, called The Colossus, wasn't part of the Statue of Liberty until 1903, when it was presented to the Bedloe Island Post Commander on a bronze plaque. Over the years, it became more and more entrenched in the history of the Statue of Liberty and used as the symbol of freedom in World War II. In 1942, Alfred Hitchcock made a movie about American freedom called Saboteur, where the heroine recited the poem in the movie. The poem, along with a portfolio of drawings of the statue, fetched $1,500 at auction, much less than the Statue of Liberty fundraisers had hoped. You've been listening to the 45th episode of Tracing the Path with Dan Armour.